much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be. Don't know much about geography. Don't know much trigonometry.
Don't know much biology, Sam Cooke says, but he knows enough to recognize love and what a wonderful world it could be. How do we know what we know and decide which kind of knowledge matters? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. My guest, Rosemary Russ, is a professor of science education, an Anne Wallace Faculty Fellow in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction at UW-Madison, and the Faculty Co-Director of Madison Teaching and Learning Excellence. She has studied ways of rethinking knowledge, whether in an elementary science classroom or inside the walls of a prison. And we're calling this hour, Knowledge Turned Upside Down. Welcome to University of the Air, Rosemary.
Thank you for having me.
If you're sitting next to someone on a plane and making small talk and they say, what do you do? How do you describe your field?
Yes. So I tend to describe my field as that I sit around and think about what counts as knowledge in different contexts and who counts as knowers in those contexts. And so sometimes I'll give the example of having it be in science class, but really I think about that anytime I walk into a room. I think about, let me assess what's going on here, what counts as knowledge, and who is seen as knowledgeable.
It sounds abstract.
Absolutely.
And what brought you to that field? I'm always curious, you know, if you find somebody who goes into marine biology or paleontology or law, often there's sort of a personal story behind what drew you to that field.
Yes.
Or, you know, what made it kind of have a spark for you?
Yes. Well, this happened actually back when I was in college. So I was a physics major undergrad. I had had this wonderful high school physics teacher who had really encouraged a bunch of her students to go into physics. So I loved physics. I had taken, you know, tons of physics classes. And to me, physics was really about understanding my everyday world. So one of my favorite things I used to think about was, why does pumping my legs on a swing make me go faster? So that was sort of my view of what physics was. And the man that I was dating at the time was forced to take a physics class for his major. And I remember him coming into the dining hall one day and just sort of throwing his books down and saying, I just hate physics. It's the worst subject ever. And of course, as a physics major, I thought, like, wow, how could this be? How could you hate physics? And he said, it's nothing but a bunch of formulas and vocabulary. It's just stupid. And in that moment, I had this realization that he and I did not think of physics in the same way, and we didn't think of knowledge in physics as the same way. I thought of it as this very tangible, everyday experiences, and he really thought of it as this pretty abstract focus on vocabulary and mathematics. And so that sort of sparked my interest of how could people see things so differently, and would he think differently about physics if he thought of it the way I did rather than the way he did?
And there's a fancy word sometimes used to describe the study of knowledge, epistemology.
I do, yes. So there's this field of epistemology, and in particular, I study what's called personal epistemology, which is people's personal views of what counts as knowledge and knowing.
Well, who gets to be seen as the knowers? Who gets to kind of decide we've got the knowledge that the others need to learn?
That's a good question. I think, you know, in formal learning settings, it's often the case that teachers are seen as knowers. But often it has to do with your position with regards to other people. So for children, it's often their parents who are seen as knowledge. For many folks, their sort of spiritual faith leaders are seen as the people who have knowledge. Let me think about how I want to talk about this more.
When do you feel like a knower?
Yes, that's a great question. So I think of myself in this context as a knower. So, Emily, you asked me to come on this show, presumably because you think I know something about something that other people might be interested in hearing. And the people who've tuned into the show must also think of me as a knower, otherwise they wouldn't have decided to listen. And at least up to this point, they must still think I'm a knower because they haven't turned it off yet. So in this context, I'm counting as the knower because I'm the person who has knowledge that's being shared.
Well, let's talk about her title, yeah. Knowledge Turned Upside Down. Why are we turning it upside down?
Well, so one of the main reasons that or one of the main challenges that I have seen happen in classrooms is that teachers hold all of this knowledge and then they just give it to their students. And oftentimes when that happens, particular kinds of knowledge are valued. And then that means that only particular students who have that particular kind of knowledge are valued. And there's this beautiful book called Epistemic Injustice, which uses that fancy word again. But the subtitle is The Power and Ethics of Knowing. It's written by a philosopher, Miranda Fricker, in 2007. And she talks about that there's real problems when some people are seen as knowers and some people are not seen as knowers. There's problems, obviously, for the people who aren't seen as knowers. They are really dehumanized. They don't have the opportunity to share in knowledge exchange that's happening in a specific space. And then they also perhaps will lose what she calls intellectual courage, which is the opportunity to share their knowledge and not back down. So you can imagine if someone is not seen as a knower in a particular context, they might not feel comfortable engaging in a disagreement with someone and trying to get people to understand what's happening.
Maybe we need a definition of knowledge, too.
You know, my mom just asked me this when I was describing to her what I was going to talk about. Knowledge for me is anything that people believe they know and anything that can be useful in a context to help you understand what's happening and how to proceed in that context.
Well, let me push back a little bit. When you said anything people believe they know.
Oh, yes.
What if you believe you know something but you're wrong?
Yeah, that's a big problem. And one of the nice things in science education is that we have all of these different mechanisms for helping people figure out whether the knowledge that they think they have is actually true. So we use knowledge from experiments. We use thought experiments. We use arguments with other people in which your knowledge has to stand up. But what this brings to mind for me is certainly right now, one of the major contested issues of knowledge is around COVID and what should be happening with COVID and what should happen with COVID. And obviously, science and science education is really hoping that people will take scientists as knowers in this context. And so they're doing all kinds of things to try to make that happen. But they want scientists to be seen as knowledgeable and as able to produce new knowledge and useful information about the virus that we can use to keep ourselves safe.
Well, let's take it to childhood. I know you've studied everything from, you know, elementary school classrooms to prisons, you know, children, adults. Let's start with something about children and how they start to learn whether they are smart, whether they are knowers, and what knowledge can mean.
Yeah. So could we play that clip that I had? Let me describe a little bit what's happening.
Sure.
So this goes on all the time in classrooms. Research shows that children as young as preschool and kindergarten know who is considered smart in their classroom. They know whether their teachers think they're smart and also whether their teachers think their families are smart. So it spreads not only from the student but to the family. And so what we're going to hear now is a clip from a beautiful children's YA book called Fish in a Tree that was written by
Linda Mullally Hunt.
Yes, thank you. That was written by Linda Mullally Hunt. And what's happening in this is sort of the opening scene of the book, is that there's a young woman who we will ultimately learn has dyslexia, though she hasn't been diagnosed yet. And she's sitting in her sixth grade class, and her teacher is going to ask her to write a paragraph. And what we hear is sort of her internal dialogue around what's happening in that moment when the teacher asks her to write a paragraph.
Well, Allie, are you going to write or aren't you? Miss Hall asks. Come on, I know you can do it. I'm only asking for one page describing yourself. It's important, she says. It's so your new teacher can get to know you. Embarrassed, I slide my drawings underneath my blank writing assignment. I've been drawing pictures of myself being shot out of a cannon. It would be easier than school. Less painful. Come on, she says, moving my lined paper toward me. Just do your best. 7 schools in 7 years, and they're all the same. Whenever I do my best, they tell me I don't try hard enough. Too messy. Careless spelling. Annoyed that the same word is spelled different ways on the same page. And the headaches. I always get headaches from looking at the brightness of dark letters on white pages for too long. Miss Hall clears her throat. The rest of the class is getting tired of me again. Chairs slide, loud sighs. Maybe they think I can't hear their words. Freak. Dumb. Loser. I wish she'd just go hang out by Albert. The walk-in Google page would get a better grade than me if he just blew his nose into the paper.
That's so sad. Where she is hearing words like freak, dumb, and loser, and feels that another child could get a better grade just by, what did it say, sneezing into the page?
Right, right, absolutely. And I remember when my daughter was reading this book several years ago, and I heard this, I just thought, wow, like this is precisely what Miranda Fricker is talking about, which is that this is a young sixth grade girl. She knows that she's not seen as smart. Her other peers know that she's not seen as smart. And as a result, she gets stuck in this loop where she feels really dumb, and she can identify who also is not dumb in her class. But when I think about sitting there and being Allie in that class, I can really, you know, feel what it must feel like to not be a knower. I, fortunately, as a result of the way that I talk, the way that I act, the way that I dress, am seen as a knower in many contexts, particularly around the university. And it's often the case that those of us who are white and middle class and well-educated and have status in some kind of organization are seen as knowers. And so we don't have to experience being called dumb or freak or loser. But that's not the case for everyone in our society.
Well, and I've seen many adults who kind of gave up on themselves in terms of school because they were labeled as dumb or tracked into a slow group or had some sort of disability that was not recognized, and they were punished or labeled in certain ways, and it can make a difference lifelong.
Absolutely, yeah. I was recently actually the first young man that I tutored in the Dane County Jail. I was tutoring him in math, and we met, and, you know, over the course of our time together, we would talk a little bit more broadly than just about math. And he told me a story about how when he was in the third grade, he said he remembered exactly where he was sitting and exactly what he was doing when his parents came in to talk to his teacher. And his teacher said, you know, your son's just not very bright. I'm not sure that he'll ever make it past the eighth grade. And so this young man, who was probably 25 at the time, still carried that with him, and it really impacted his view of himself. But one thing that I want to also highlight is that it's not just the people who are labeled as not smart or as not knowers who suffer when we do this kind of thing. And this is one of the things I really appreciate in Fricker's work, is that also the rest of us, our community, really loses out when we label some people as not knowers and some people as knowers.
Well, sure, because we don't hear their voices or their experience at all. It looks like you have another clip from the fish in the tree.
Yeah, absolutely. In this clip, Allie, the young woman who sees herself as not a knower, is finally writes something on the page that she's pretty proud of, and we're going to hear sort of what happens when that is made public.
Mrs. Silver leans over to look at my paper. I figure I might finally get a compliment for once. But instead, her eyebrows bunch up and she motions me toward the door. Shay has gotten up to look. She laughs and says, "The world gets dumber every time Allie Nickerson speaks." "Shay, sit down," Mrs. Paul says. "But it's too late. You can't make people unhear something. I should be used to this, but it still takes a piece out of me every time."
Yeah, so this is sort of exactly what you and I were just talking about, Emily, that these things stick with people and that it does take a little piece out of them anytime they're reminded of the fact that the world doesn't see them as knowers, or at least in this moment they aren't seen as knowers.
It's really painful to hear something like that.
Yeah, and to I'm fortunate that I don't hear that very often in my life. The only time that I used to even get a small glimpse of what this might be like is, so my back when I was in grad school or when I was a postdoc, my graduate work is actually in physics. And so I would go to parties and people would say, you know, Rosemary, what do you study? Or, you know, what's your program? And I'd say, oh, I'm in physics. And immediately when you say you're in physics, people automatically assume that you're incredibly smart. For some reason, that domain carries with it a lot of cachet in terms of knowledge. And so people would be very impressed with me. And then all of a sudden they would ask me, well, what are you studying? And I would tell them that I was studying how people learned physics and that I was sort of veering towards the field of education. And immediately I became less smart. All of a sudden, just by saying that I was in education rather than in physics, immediately I was seen as less smart. And so that for me always really stands out as how people judge one another constantly in terms of who counts as a knower and who doesn't.
And I suppose we use the phrase, he's no rocket science, where scientists, right. Where a rocket scientist becomes the sort of paragon of knowledge.
It is, absolutely. Yeah.
You don't say, he's no preschool teacher.
No.
But we all know that a preschool teacher working with, you know, little ones has an incredible amount of knowledge.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so that's one of the things when I think about knowledge turned upside down. What I think about is how do we begin to flip that narrative in our culture of what counts as knowledge? How do we begin to have people say, wow, you must be a preschool teacher? Because preschool teachers have this huge wealth of lived experience with how to interact with humans that, you know, most rocket scientists don't have. And how do we begin to value that kind of lived experience as knowledge rather than these formulas and theories that make up sort of rocket science?
Well, and we also have the difference between the kind of knowledge you can get in a book and the kind of knowledge you have from living it. Example that stands out in my mind is when I was in the hospital after my third childbirth, and I was nursing my third child, and a medical student, a third-year medical student who had only been on the service 2 weeks, walked in and asked me, do you have any questions about breastfeeding?
Yes. Sure, they were prepared to give you all kinds of knowledge from a book about that.
I hope I said, do you? But I don't even remember. It's kind of a new mom fog. But
right.
But the difference between someone who might have read about breastfeeding in a book versus someone who has done it, that brings up this whole difference in the kinds of knowledge that exist.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in our culture, we do really value this knowledge from books. We see that in all kinds of places in our society, and we see it come up in classrooms all the time, that students who are able to memorize and repeat back facts that they learned in a book are perceived as smarter, as being more knowers, than those students who might have lived everyday experience with the thing that we're talking about.
We're going to look at the way children are taught science, whether it's in a program like Magic School Bus or in classroom discussions, when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
Is it just me, or is it getting really warm?
Miss Frizzle, what happens when water gets warm? Do I really want to know?
Gosh, I'm rising into the air.
When water is warmed by the sun, it evaporates.
You mean we're evaporating? Help!
I want to be water again.
We still are water, Arnold. When water evaporates, it turns into water vapor.
It's a gas, Arnold.
We've been vaporized.
I get it. First we were a liquid, then we became a gas. I still don't like it.
Oh, it's getting cold up here.
Hey, I'm unvaporizing. Look at my hand. I'm turning into tiny droplets.
That's because we're changing back into a liquid. We are condensing. Water is as water does.
That's from The Magic School Bus, an episode Wet All Over. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Rosemary Russ, and we are talking about knowledge turned upside down. Specifically, we're talking about how science is taught to children. Tell me about your reaction to a show like that.
So, you know, I'm delighted that we have begun to try to make science fun for kids, right? So we think about shows like Magic School Bus or Bill Nye the Science Guy, Wildcrats. My children loved those shows. And I'm really pleased in that we're bringing science to younger children. But the thing that stands out to me in that clip is that clip's about a minute long. And in it, there are at least 5 new vocabulary words for kids to learn. So we heard evaporate. We heard vaporize, water vapor, liquid, gas, and condensing. So that's 6 different vocabulary words, all to describe what happens basically in the water cycle when things start out, when we start with a puddle on the ground, and then it evaporates up into the cloud and then comes back down into the puddle through the process of condensation. And so for me, what stands out is that science, even in this really fun kind of silly idea where the kids are being water droplets themselves, is still rooted in these vocabulary words that you have to know and that you have to have learned from your book in order to count as smart.
Well, what's wrong with that?
Yes.
In other words, like let's say I learn the word gravity.
Yes.
If I learn what gravity is, am I not learning science?
Yeah, you are. I think one of the major challenges for me is that often we stop at the level of just having the vocabulary word. So there's a lot of focus, for example, in early science education around photosynthesis and chlorophyll. And I remember when my son was learning this, we went for a hike one day and we were talking about why do the leaves change color. And he said, well, because of photosynthesis. And for him, that was the level of knowledge that he had. He only had that word because that was what they had talked about in their class. They had talked about that word, and that's what the assessments had tested him on, was this word photosynthesis and the word chlorophyll. And so there's a couple of problems with that. And the first one is that, right, just having that word doesn't actually tell us anything about the process. Just because I say the word evaporate or the word photosynthesis, it doesn't mean that I actually understand what's happening physically in the world. And there's this beautiful term from cognitive science, the cognitive scientist Frank Kyle, who talks about the illusion of explanatory depth. And that's the idea that when we have a word for something, we think we understand it. And so that's what's happening in a lot of these cases in schools, is that we think we understand it, or we think our students understand it because they have a word, and actually they don't. So that's one problem, is that people who maybe shouldn't be considered knowers are being considered knowers just because they know the word.
So if you have what sounds like a fancy vocabulary, but you're just parroting it,
exactly,
you're just saying the word and sounding smart, it doesn't translate into real knowledge. I think about in third grade, I remember my son's class, they were asked to use vocabulary words in sentences, and one of the vocabulary words was romantic, and his 5 sentences were, he doesn't know what romantic means, she doesn't know what romantic means, we don't know,
right,
they don't know what romantic. So he used it in sentences without ever having to actually define romantic. And you can do that with something like photosynthesis or metamorphosis or, you know, chrysalis or evaporation. You can certainly say it without understanding it.
Absolutely. And when we look at what assessments of science look like, which, and to be fair, right, it's hard to have a pen and paper assessment of a discipline that is about experimentation and that is about trying things out. You know, I'm not blaming people who make assessments in this. Certainly, I think they're doing their best. But when we look at questions, we see things like, what is the process by which leaves change color in the fall? And so then the sort of A, B, C, D are different vocabulary words. And so there we're still just testing at the level of vocabulary and not really testing for some sort of deeper understanding of what's happening.
Well, how do you get to that deeper understanding? And if you think about it, teachers, we know, are overworked and underpaid, and sometimes they have to teach a certain amount of knowledge, test on it, and move on.
Absolutely.
And they're dealing with standardized tests that their students, and assessments that the students have to take, which often are not fair to children coming out of homes where there's fewer vocabulary words being spoken.
Absolutely.
But what, you know, how do you teach? Let's say with your son walking along and answering photosynthesis, what would take that from that word to a sort of deeper understanding?
Yeah, so one of the things that I have talked about in my work in the past is helping students to try to develop a causal story about what's happening when something occurs or when one of these vocabulary words is happening. So, you know, for example, I asked my son in that moment, fortunately we had some pen and paper with us because we were doing some other things, and I said, you know, can you draw me a picture of that? What do you think is actually happening there? And in science education, we talk a lot about using pictures or models to help students, and that really requires then that they think about, well, what's actually in play here? What is inside a leaf? And what does the sun actually do? And so asking students to think really carefully about entities that exist in the real world rather than thinking about these vocabulary words.
And if you do have a dialogue between a teacher and a student, we don't want a situation like in the young adult book that you had clips for.
Absolutely.
Where the teacher, you know, sort of, I guess, belittles the answer or the response. When you do have a back and forth, you know, what do you think is happening, or, you know, what picture can you show? What kind of role does a teacher play in responding to students who may see the world differently?
Absolutely. This is one of the things that I talk a lot about with my undergraduate students. So here at UW, I teach people who will become elementary teachers, and in particular early childhood teachers, how to teach science. And so I get this opportunity to talk with teachers about what are you going to say when someone in your class says something that either doesn't make sense or that makes sense but doesn't use the vocabulary word. And so we do a lot of practice with that because, as you said, teachers are under a lot of pressure. They have a lot to cover in their classroom. They have a lot of things going on. And so asking them to sort of focus on students' ideas and evaluate them for non-vocabulary and trying to articulate what's good in students' ideas can be really challenging for them. And I actually brought a clip that I use with my teachers to talk about this, so maybe we can ground the conversation in that.
Is this the Michael one?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, so you know, maybe I should set the clip up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I used this clip with my elementary pre-service teachers, and this is a clip of a young boy named Michael, and he is having an interview actually with his mother, who's a science teacher. She just asked him to sit down and talk to her, and this is a clip about a condensation and evaporation, sort of part of the water cycle, which is why I wanted to play it. So Michael's going to share his ideas about what is the stuff that comes out of our mouth when it's cold outside. So for those of us who live in Wisconsin, we certainly know that in the winter, when we breathe out, there's sort of smoke or fog that comes out. And Michael's going to explain what he thinks is happening when that happens.
When we are outside and it's cold outside, sometimes when we talk, we get this like
steam out of our mouth?
Yeah.
Oh, that?
What is that?
Steam. That's steam. Because when we breathe, it's hot. And the thing is cold.
What thing is cold?
Like, you know how when you put, like, charcoal in a fire?
Mm-hmm.
It's, like, just right. And then when you burn the fire, it burns.
What is it that you put in the fire?
Steam comes up in the air, because fire is hotter than normal air. So it makes steam, exactly like a train. So, like, when we breathe, it's hot. And the air is cold. So, when we breathe, it makes steam.
Mm. How come it's not coming off all of our body if we're hot and the air is cold? How come it's only coming out of our mouth?
Because we're wearing layers and layers and layers. It doesn't really do anything. Because, like, the air, when it touches it, it just bounces off. It doesn't feel the cold. Like, the outside of it is cold. But the inside of it is you. You're warm. So, because, like, when we go out there, we get cold. So then, like, it's with the air. It's as cold as the air. So then we can't do steam.
So would you see any steam coming through?
Only if we breathe. Like, if we go... steam comes out.
But why is that if we're the same temperature as outside then?
The inside is always hot. The inside of you is always hot. And it comes out of the inside of you.
I see. So even...
It's like when you breathe it in. Once it gets down to your lungs, it's already hot. Then when it comes out, it's hot.
Mm.
And makes steam.
Because when you breathe in, the air goes to your lungs?
Yeah. And it makes it hot.
So if one of the things that when I talk with my teachers, Michael has gone on here for about 2 minutes in a sort of rambling kind of way, right? Michael was in first grade when he recorded this. And so, yeah, so he kind of rambles on and on a little bit, right? And there's parts that I'm really not sure I understand. So as a teacher, right, you can imagine it would be much easier and much more efficient if Michael had just said the air condenses. And then you could move on. But instead, as a teacher, you're stuck with this long, rambling thing that actually has a lot of good stuff in it, and good stuff that I would like teachers to recognize and that science education has talked about, that it would be nice if this kind of knowledge, this kind of answer could be valued in science class.
So let's say Michael was in the classroom with you and you were his first grade teacher. What would you pick up on in that discussion of fire, of the layers of the body, the lungs, you know, all the different things he said? What would you pick up on?
Yeah, so one thing that I would pick up on is he's a first grader. I happen to know that he loved Thomas the Train, as many first graders do. And so one he picks up on, it's steam. It's exactly like a train. So here we see him using his lived experience, which is from watching Thomas the Train and learning about trains. So first I would pick on that and say, you know, Michael, I noticed that you were talking about a train. Can you tell me, how does a train like the body? Or could you draw me a picture of how the train is like the body? So that's one thing that I might pick up on. The other thing I would pick up on is this really nice causal story of how this happens. So he's talking about there being air outside that then goes into my body, gets hot, and then comes back out, and then that the hot air touches the cold air, and that makes the steam. So I would ask him to articulate that a little bit more. And then I might ask other students, what do they think about this idea? Do they agree that it's hot inside our bodies? Do they not agree? And so again, pulling on this everyday knowledge that students have about how our bodies work, what they've experienced, they've felt their breath often, so it feels hot, or having other students pick up on the train, and do they believe that the train is the right analogy or metaphor to use here?
Well, I can see that using the Socratic method of using questions and drawing out the knowledge works well. Mm-hmm. But what would you do if you were in that same classroom and Michael, instead of talking about the body and steam and other things, had said, well, the reason our breath shows is because we are secret dragons. And went into a tale about Puff the Magic Dragon and all kinds of things. How would you respond as a teacher?
Wow, that's a beautiful thought, because that often happens, right? Is that students come up with these kind of ideas that aren't rooted in what we know physically happens in the world. So I think, again, for that one, what I would try to do would be to push him towards saying, well, why do dragons have steam, and why do they create steam? What's happening there? Because one thing that I know from my lived experience of reading about dragons is that dragons spray out fire. So we still could have the notion of there being hot things, and that hot things touching cold things creates steam.
But at some point, wouldn't a teacher sort of need to distinguish between facts and make-believe?
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm not suggesting that we just sort of accept every student idea as hugely valuable. But what I want to point out is that lived experience and the ideas that students bring to the table can often have little seeds of productive thinking. That's what my former advisor used to call them, seeds of productive thinking. And so even this dragon idea has this productive notion of fire. And so instead of pulling out the dragon part of this, I would pull out the fire part of this. Mm-hmm. And so even in really, really wrong ideas, often there are little seeds that we can pull out. Another strategy that I've seen used in classrooms and that I've used is to then pair students up with people who have different ideas and, again, start to try to wrestle with which of these makes the most sense. And so whether that involves bringing in some kind of experiment to show them what happens, maybe it involves showing them the episode of Magic School Bus. But certainly we want to bring students into contact with correct ideas. But it's always nice if we can find even a tiny seed of what of one piece that, of an explanation that might be valuable and correct.
I want to ask you about science projects in elementary school.
Yes.
It's one thing that drove my father nuts mm-hmm. because he's a research scientist.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And the projects, for example, that my son was asked to do, which can be a parent's nightmare, you know, when you have to go to school with a project. But
right.
anyway, the grading of the project included marks for neatness.
Yes.
And the solution.
Yes.
And my father argued that science is messy,
mm-hmm.
that if
mm-hmm.
you take risks, you might end up with
no solution.
Looks good, and that you really want to value the creative thinking, being outside of the box, having a hypothesis, finding a way to test it, that the things being measured in the school science project were in many ways anti-science.
Yeah, that's such a beautiful view of what school science projects are, because often they are, right, in the same way that assessments are reductionist and reduce science knowledge to vocabulary. Often these kind of school science projects really reduce science to going through a set of steps. And one of the most recent standards documents that's come out in science education, the Next Generation Science Standards, has been very clear that that sort of step-by-step method doesn't make sense, that that's not actually what knowledge in science looks like, and it's not how knowledge in science is built, that it is a much messier process that involves pulling in knowledge from lots of different places. It involves some experimentation that often fails, and then you try again in a different way. And so, yeah, I think, again, what I see in these school science projects is an attempt to standardize and assess something that really doesn't lend itself well to standardization.
And grading can really put a damper on what people do, too. I also remember in high school biology where you had to draw a certain thing that you were supposed to see in the microscope and then would be graded on it. And I learned to just make a picture of what I was supposed to be seeing because actually all I saw was my eyelashes.
Yes.
But that would have not led to a good grade. And,
right.
you know, there is this pressure, I think, to be correct rather than accurate and
Absolutely.
To parrot rather than to question.
That's such a beautiful way to say that, Emily. I think that's exactly right. And that grading really does drive a large portion of what students do in school. We know that all the way up through our undergraduates, right? And so trying to expand what it is that we're assessing and how we're assessing it is incredibly important.
I know you've also looked at the approach to knowledge behind bars. And we're going to talk about that when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. To know that we know what we know, and to know that we do not know what we do not know, that is true knowledge. So said Copernicus. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Rosemary Russ. We are talking about knowledge turned upside down. You've been working mostly with training teachers in how to teach science, in studying different kinds of knowledge and how we learn. But I know more recently you've also turned your gaze on jails and prisons. Can you tell me how you got into that angle of work?
Yes. So after I had been doing work in science education for, 15 years, I decided that I wanted to do some work outside the university, that I was feeling somewhat constrained by my job at the university. And so I looked into tutoring in our local jail. And fortunately, they had a spot for me. It turns out they have a lot of English tutors, but not a lot of folks who can do math and science. And so I was excited to be able to do that. And I already shared the story of how when I started talking with my learner, he shared with me this notion that he had been perceived as not smart. And in that moment was when I realized, oh my gosh, the same thing that I've been studying in science and that I've been worrying about in science is happening for kids all over the place and is happening in particular for people who are not successful in our school system and who often end up incarcerated. And so that's how I got into starting to think about what does it look like and what does knowledge look like in this arena of incarceration.
Wisconsin has a pretty abysmal record when it comes to who lands up behind bars. Can you talk about Wisconsin's jails and prisons and what we're looking at right now?
Yes, absolutely. So in Wisconsin, as you said, we incarcerate really a large number of people in explosion in the last 20 years, particularly of women. And one thing that the 2021 report from the Sentencing Project talks about, that Wisconsin leads the nation, but it's not in a good way. So we lead the nation in black imprisonment rates. So although nationally one in every 81 black adults is incarcerated, which is in itself a pretty abysmal number, in Wisconsin it's even worse. In Wisconsin we incarcerate one for every 36 black folks in our community. And for me, that's a huge problem. And for a lot of folks in our community, that's a big problem. And so people are starting to talk about what could we do to try to shift that statistic.
And that rate, the disparity between black and white imprisonment, is one of the highest in the nation.
Absolutely.
Right? And what are some of the causes that you see of that racial disparity in our jails and prisons?
Well, I think, you know, there's a range of different causes. Certainly the systemic and structural racism that's involved in the identifying of crime and the identifying of folks who have committed crimes, all of those things contribute to this racial disparity. And I actually don't necessarily study what contributes to it. There are all kinds of folks in sociology that are doing that. But I'm starting to think about more, how could we start to shift that?
Well, and certainly poverty plays a role as well. If you don't have a chance to pay bail, or you don't have money for a fancy lawyer,
absolutely,
or if you go into a courtroom where you have people with stereotypes and biases already there.
Absolutely. All of those things.
Mm-hmm. And how does that affect, I mean, what is the relationship then between this terrible situation of incarceration in mm-hmm. Wisconsin mm-hmm. and then your study of knowledge?
Yes. So I think I mentioned at the start of the hour that one of the things, or maybe I didn't, one of the things that I always think about when I come into a new situation is what counts as knowledge in this context and who counts as knowers. And so when I heard my students say, my teacher saw me as dumb, immediately I realized that folks who have been incarcerated or who are currently incarcerated are often seen as not knowers. And so I wanted to try to start to look at, what can we do about that? What kinds of things are happening about that? And what I found is that there's been a couple of different approaches to trying to shift these imprisonment rates and to try to shift what's happening in our community. One of the major approaches has been to offer programming in prisons so that those who are incarcerated can sort of better themselves so that they won't end up reincarcerated and so that they're in a better position when they're released. We know that more than 80% of people who are incarcerated will end up back in our communities. And so there's this push to have programming in jails and prisons that will support people in sort of leading more, quote unquote, productive lives. So there are programs for becoming a better parent, for mindfulness, for getting your GED, higher education, cognitive restructuring, alcohol and drug addiction, vocational education, all of these kinds of programs that the DOC or folks from universities, for example, myself included, offer to folks who are incarcerated. And I love these programs, and I think they do a world of good for shifting people's views of themselves. But even in those contexts, it is those of us who design and teach in the program who are often seen as having knowledge. And so I start to wonder, how can we teach differently, or how can we use these programs as a way to support people who are in the programs, who are inside as viewing themselves as knowers, so that when they come out, they can use their knowledge that they have.
In other words, empowerment. So you
Absolutely.
Teach in a way not just to give knowledge, but to impart that sense of, I guess, self-awareness and knowledge of one's own power.
Absolutely. So developing their identities as knowers. We want them to think of themselves as knowers. And one of the frustrating challenges that I have found recently, I've been working with the group EXPO, which is Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing, is that folks who go through these programs do leave feeling very empowered for themselves. But then often when they come out as a result of their conviction and incarceration histories, are not seen as knowers again. So, for example, in Madison in particular, there's all kinds of criminal justice reform committees that are happening to try to remove some of these barriers that you were talking about, Emily, to think about what do we do about bail? What do we do about these incarceration disparities that we have? But even in these contexts, what we're seeing is that it's typically elected officials, law enforcement, and Department of Corrections who are at the table having this conversation. So we have all these people coming out who have seen themselves as knowers as a result of some of this empowering education and who have a huge amount of lived experience with the system, and yet they're not being tapped to make sense of how could we shift the criminal justice system to make it a better place. So again, here we see that we're not valuing lived experience.
In fact, we're making it so that if you try to do something after getting out of prison, if you check that box or, you know, fail the criminal background thing, you're often excluded from all kinds of positions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's just seldom the case that incarcerated folks are invited to give their perspective and experiences on something that they actually have a ton of experience with and that they have a ton of knowledge about.
I understand that you wrote a poem about some of this.
I co-wrote a poem with a colleague of mine, Dennis Franklin, who is a fellow at Expo, because I sat down and I talked to him and I said, you know, Dennis, you must have so much knowledge about what the system could look like such that it would actually be transformative, such that we could transform it. And so we wrote this poem together that's called We Are Experts.
We are experts. We are experts in surviving and thriving in an inhumane system. We are experts in supporting one another through dark days and light ones. We are experts in maintaining relationships with those we cannot see or speak to or hold on a daily basis. We are experts in the law and its effects on us. We are experts in sharing lived experience with those who need to hear them. We are experts in fact finding. We are experts in holding each other accountable. We are experts in drawing out our past experiences to make decisions for the future. We are experts in seeing injustice and how it impacts our communities in unhealthy ways. We are experts in recognizing a problem. We are experts in designing appropriate solutions. We are experts at making something out of nothing. We are experts.
I love that. The message in it, the lines about surviving and thriving, and just sort of, I guess, proclaiming all the different ways that you can be an expert.
Absolutely. That was what was so powerful for me in really supporting Dennis and writing the poem. I really think of him as sort of the primary author, that he, as a result of being in this incredibly dehumanizing space for however long people find themselves there, they have generated a lot of wisdom and knowledge. They have a lot of lived experience about how the mail system works, how canteen works. Are there better ways that we could do visitation? They have all of this lived knowledge that they're ready to share. And yet our community is over and over and over again creating committees to make change that don't involve people who have real knowledge about this.
It reminds me of a student in my UW Odyssey project class who was told she was not college material by a Madison High School guidance counselor, and she's now on her way to earning a bachelor's with honors and taking Chinese. And I think,
wonderful.
You know, we miss out on so many voices, so many incredible experiences by excluding people from what we call knowledge, not looking at what they have as knowledge.
Absolutely. Yeah, it goes back to what we talked about at the very beginning, that it's not just these individuals who are seen as not knowers who are suffering. Our community is really suffering for not having these voices at the table.
In the few minutes we have left, give me your takeaways. You're back on the plane. Somebody has asked you, what do you do? And you've, you know, said something about epistemology and knowledge,
yes,
about knowledge and so on. And now you've got, before they get off that plane, they say, so what should we do? I mean, after all, Anton Chekhov said knowledge is of no value unless you put it into practice. So what do we do differently? We go back out into our lives and do what?
Yeah. So first, I would love if everyone would go back into their lives to look around to see who's counting as knowledgeable in whatever context you find yourself. Who's counted as knowledgeable in whatever context you find yourself? Who is sitting at the table with you solving problems, and what knowledge are they bringing? And then ask ourselves what knowledge is missing. And most often, the knowledge that's missing is lived experience. So, for example, I was recently on a committee here at UW about the student undergraduate experience and how to improve it. I look around the table. There's not a single student in the room, right? So, again, being the person who asks that question so for those of us who are seen as knowers, being able to say, who's not at this table?
Oh, like for women's health, where it might be a committee of men.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. So for those of us who are seen as knowers and who are asked to be in the room, we need to just be asking over and over and over again, where is the lived experience? Where are the people who have lived experience? And why are they not at the table?
Anything else that you would call on us to do?
I actually don't think so. For me, what I think about is that we can shift who counts as knowers in our communities, but doing that is going to require changing what we count as knowledge.
And if you were addressing an incoming class of teachers?
For them, I always start with, who do you see as smart? Who are seen as knowers for you? What are the things that they bring to the table? And then how can you as a teacher start to value those things?
My guest has been Rosemary Russ. She's a professor in the Curriculum and Instruction Department, professor of science education, and the faculty co-director of Madison Teaching and Learning Excellence. Rosemary, thanks for joining me. It's been eye-opening.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be. Trigonometry. Don't know much about algebra. Don't know what a sliding room is for. But I do know what it was too. And if this one could be with you, what a wonderful world this would be. Now I don't claim to be an A student, but I'm trying to be. For maybe by being an A student, baby, I can win your love for me. Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. Ta-ta. Yes.